You have given very good examples of this when, in your earlier books, you talk a lot about your relationship with parents. And there you say, well, here I am saying my mantra while my father continues about my mother's death, and I don't want to hear that, but this is, I suppose, what I'm supposed to do.
My father and I, for example, and my stepmother play Yahtzee, which is it's a little game with dice, and it's a very simple little game. And we play it almost every night. It's part of our little dance together. Now, if I were busy being a Yahtzee player, I would be bored to distraction, right? But I'm really not. I'm just a spacious being who happens to be playing Yahtzee at that moment, just like at this moment my heart's beating and my digestive tract is working. And I'm just appreciating the whole phenomenon. And there is a spaciousness that creates a vibratory rate that is very different from the vibratory rate that would be created if I were busy being a Yahtzee player. And as we play Yahtzee, my father and my stepmother, very slowly the whole vibration changes until in that situational condition, nobody there is playing Yahtzee, although we are all playing Yahtzee. We have transcended it. It's a contact high, if you will, out of that moment. Right? Now, there's no way that I can express that to them or train them, or because they don't want to, nor do they need to. I'm just doing my part, and their experience. So they end up, they can't get to the Yahtzee board fast enough, although they don't know why. They just say, this is a great game, you know.
Yes, often it happens that people develop some rituals, and they know that something happens during the ritual. They don't know why.
And then they get hooked on the ritual if they don't understand. That's part of what religion has been the history of.
Also part of what relationships are about. Like we get into the marriage ritual, and some things happen and some things don't happen. We get stuck up into the aspects that happen.
I understand.
And don't realize what makes us
beautiful.
Ecstatic.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Let's talk about a very confusing subject for a little bit. Self-will or free will and determinism. Mm. Now, of course, you know, sciences are used to be completely caught up in determinism. Ever since Descartes saw this automatic machine in the Palace of Versailles, there is this story. And he saw these things work and work beautifully, the machines. And he thought, aha, God's world must work the same way. And Newton came around and he made these laws, and everything seemed to work that same way for quite a while, for 200, 300 years, I would say. And then only recently we're beginning to realize that, no, it quite doesn't. It does not quite work in the deterministic fashion. But then there's confusion again, because you introduced the idea of indeterminacy, and that too tend to disappear when introduced these ideas of cosmic consciousness. Or is there somebody behind the scene who is the really one who is pulling the strings, and there isn't really any free will, but everything happens, you just do your thing. How do you deal with that?
Well, in your comment just now, you covered at least five levels of consciousness, five levels of reality, all right? And in a way, they are all relatively real. So that there is a plane at which, like you and I chose to be here together for this interview, that is a level at which we subjectively experience free will. But you and I both know that those thought forms that made us decide this didn't come out of a vacuum. They came out of previous thoughts and experiences and our reading of in these realms and so on. And so in the sense that was all lawful, we know that one level back, it's pretty much within law. Within another relative, a larger relative reality, it is determined.
Yes.
Now then you say, but within a larger relative reality, it is again undetermined. And then you say, within a larger relative reality, which is God, it is again lawful, even the indeterminacy, right? And in a way, those are all systems that are all equally relatively real. So that to say, is it determinism or free will, is just a confusion. That's the another one of those paradoxes, that the answer is they're both true, but they're only relatively true. They're not absolutely true. And the confusion is that when we say, is it this or that, we are talking about something in a kind of horizontal saying, is it within the same plane of reality? And these are true across planes of reality. And paradox always can continually exist across planes.
Yes, and paradoxes never stop. By the very nature of it, there is no end to the paradox.
There's no end to the paradox, exactly. And now, being comfortable with paradox is part of what these changes of consciousness are.
Right. And in some sense, being enlightened means being able to live with paradoxes,
exactly,
with perfect calm.
Exactly, yeah.
There is, however, in some of the places you make the comment and make it very well, that ultimately there is just one item of ultimate free will. When you go through the sixth chakra in your language,
yeah,
and you come to acceptance of nirvana or not,
yeah,
then whether you are going to go into it or coming out of it, not go into it, come to serve, that is an ultimate choice that all,
yeah,
humans have.
Yeah, it's a beauty.
Obviously, Nim Karoli Baba had been there. And he comes back and serves. Now, when you meet him, what happens to your free will? Because Nim Karoli Baba, of course, changes things radically. I mean, he becomes the undetermined element within, what you say, the dharmic law.
Yeah.
And since you are attached to that undetermined element yourself,
yeah,
don't you get an element of free will by association with the guru?
That's incredible. I think what happens is that I just expand out into another system in which the determinacy is by a different set of laws than the laws of determinacy by which we usually play. We just went through to that third plane we're talking about the determinacy behind the indeterminacy, and that's what I tune into, because I felt when I was around Maharaji like a marionette being played with on strings, you know, and yet I didn't feel like he was doing it to me. I just felt that I was a totally programmed entity, not by anybody. It's not paranoia that somebody's doing it to me. I may be doing it to myself. But I saw that everything that was in form, thought, body, action, feelings, were all within that system.
Is that where your image of I'm just a renter came from?
Yeah, exactly. And that all form was going to be within some kind of law, whether you call it the Tao, you know, the natural law, or whether you try to, you know, it's not man law, it's not rational law, analytic law, but it's law.
Mm-hmm. The confusion, of course, you know, in the social regime, we find tremendous confusion because of this free will or,
yeah,
deterministic conflict,
yeah,
that we all have. You have touched upon things like getting involved in suffering versus getting involved with knowing yourself and how to resolve that. That is, do both.
Mm.
But how could you elaborate on that? I mean, you know, right now, today, there is just so much of social consciousness work,
yeah,
that we seem to feel that we need to do.
Oh, absolutely.
Whereas it cannot be done without working on ourselves.
Yeah.
So, you know, what should we really do? I mean, how much social involvement should we have? And how much of the personal
From
work?
A point of view of the ultimate relief of suffering, the amount of social action should be based on your level of evolution, meaning your ability to stay conscious in the action, meaning not identifying with being the actor or not identifying with the fruits of the action in the Bhagavad Gita sense. So at some stages, you can be very little into social action because you'll get caught almost immediately. And the minute you're caught, you are actually producing the opposite effect of what you're trying to produce.